Welcome to Concurrent 8A. My name is Kwame Achu, and I will be chairing this session. To present a topic on behavioral insights in claims management to improve return to work and other customer outcomes, we have three experts from PwC. On my immediate right is Andrew Smith. Now, Andrew is a partner of PwC's actuarial and risk practice. He has over 20 years' experience in accident compensation and general insurance industry. He's been with PwC for over 14 years, including 2 years in London. Andrew advised both state government insurance schemes as well as many of Australia's large general insurance companies. He has a deep understanding of a broad range of issues and experience across the general insurance and reinsurance classes, spanning strategic advice, portfolio reserving, pricing, and management information and monitoring systems. Prior to joining PwC, Andrew worked for a number of large general insurance companies in Australia. He's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries Australia. Next to Andrew is Jason Collins. Jason is a co-lead of PwC's Behavioral Economics Practice, a multidisciplinary group that applies the latest behavioral science in the public and private sectors to understand customer, employee, and citizen behavior. At PwC, Jason has applied behavioral economics to areas including insurance, claimant behavior, retail sales, business compliance, financial services, and regulation. Also, it extends to debt collection, internal company communications, and charitable donations. Jason has a PhD in economics and evolutionary biology, where he researched how human evolution has shaped economic thinking and decision making. Jason is also a co-founder of the Sydney Behavioral Economics Network. And last but not least, we have Chow Chow. Chow is a consultant with PwC's actuarial and risk practice. He advises clients in the insurance industry on issues ranging from forecasting, monitoring, data collection, experience analysis, reinsurance, capital, and return to work. Chow has recently explored ways to combine actuarial analytics with behavioral economics to deliver better return to work outcomes to workers' compensation claimants. Over the years, Chow has maintained a keen interest in socially relevant research and discussions, especially on longevity insurance. Chow graduated from the New South Wales University with a first-class honours in actuarial studies, and he's also a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries. He's also a chartered enterprise risk actuary, and as a young actuary, he actively volunteers at the Institute, most recently on council, focusing on issues such as education and new practice areas. Just a bit of housekeeping. Just to keep within the time limits, we'd have all the three presenters talk first, and then just note your questions, and then the floor is open for questions. You can just use the mics on either side. So without wasting any more time, I would invite Andrew to kick off the session.
Thanks, Kwame. And it's great to see so many people here, and good afternoon, everyone. Behavioural insights, mentions of behaviour, have certainly had a wrap in the last couple of days. I think I've counted the official tally up to about 196 references of behaviour. I'm not sure if that's true, but certainly behaviour has been a big focus of the last couple of days. And I think that's really, really important because behaviour is really at the centre of the relationships that exist within some of these schemes. Greg McCarthy, I think, started off the references to behaviour yesterday with references to mobile case management. Caroline Howe certainly made a few references to behaviour. Last night's plenary, we had plenty of references to behaviour and behavioural economics and behaviour in the system. And we had a fantastic paper from Rebecca Nielsen yesterday on this very topic on behavioural thinking and behavioural economics. Can I have a quick show of hands of who was here yesterday for Rebecca's? Okay, that was my quick way of finding out who wasn't here, which is good because I think there is a little bit of overlap between our presentation and Rebecca's presentation. Given the importance of this topic, I don't think that's a problem and we won't make any apology for that. But hopefully you find that there's a little bit of different content for those who were with us yesterday. I think across the country there's been a concerted effort to improve return to work outcomes within workers' comp schemes. I was going to talk about the improvements in return to work, and I think that's my reference is that that's true, but the graph I think that Nikki put up this morning sort of indicated that it's been flat. I was very relieved to see Julie Evans' slide to suggest that there's been improvements in Victoria. So I'm actually really excited about this as a topic. I think that this has the opportunity to be a bit of a game changer in return to work outcomes, and we've had some success in this field, and I think the guys will talk through that. Now, how do I work this? So by way of a quick agenda, I'm really just going to set the scene. I'm then going to hand over to Jason Collins. As Kwame said, Jason's our behavioural economist. He's going to run through what behavioural economics is all about and, importantly, put that into the context of workers' comp and return to work. Chow will then share a few case studies which demonstrate how a focus on behaviour can lead to step changes in outcomes. So here we have a cyclical representation. At the middle, we've got our behavioural economist. Our behavioural economist has a strong customer focus. They have expertise to identify game-changing behavioural interventions in whatever field, and you heard in Jason's citation that he's worked in a number of different industries. As actuaries, we understand workers' comp, we understand CTP, we understand the long-term nature of claims. We are good at technical data analysis, we've got a good industry knowledge. And it's important that we've got that cyclical relationship with the behavioural economists. They're the ones that are going to come up with ideas, but they need a reference. They need an understanding of the levers in the return to work or claims management journey to then think of the ideas that can lead to change. But how do you know whether some of those changes have actually worked? How do you know that they've led to improvement? That's where we as actuaries have the skills to be able to measure outcomes in a control environment against a test group, and Chow's going to talk through this in a minute. Doing that in a pilot scenario then allows you to understand which interventions worked, which didn't, go back to the drawing board if you need to, and again continue that cyclical relationship with a behavioural economist. Once you know what's worked and what's leading to step change, you can then upscale, and inevitably there's a range of change management that comes off the back of that. Before I do hand over to Jason, I just want you to keep in mind a couple of challenges in optimising return to work outcomes, and these have been referenced quite extensively in the last few days. So the first is that early communication sometimes has a tendency towards an adversarial claims relationship or claims environment, and a good example of that is reasonable excuse letters, and I think Jason might be potentially touching on that. From that point on, there can be a lack of trust between the claimant and the claims manager, and Rebecca's presentation yesterday certainly mentioned that initially there was a significant degree of lack of trust between police officers, medically discharged police officers, and the claims managers. And there's also a tendency for there to be a strained relationship between the employer and the injured worker. So I'm going to pause there. I'm going to hand over to Jason to run us through how we can use this concept of behavioural economics to add value.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. So I'm now going to just quickly do a quick behavioural economics 101 for those who did miss yesterday's presentation. And I use the term behavioural economics with a slight apology in that behavioural science might be a better phrase for what I'm actually talking about, but behavioural economics is the word which a lot of people understand, and so I've fallen into that habit. So to start with, I'll introduce you to what I'm going to call Citizen 1. Now, Citizen 1 you could also think of as being Customer 1, Claimant 1, Claims Manager 1. So this is basically anyone. So Customer 1 has all the time, attention and ability in the world. They can work out any problem you put in front of them. They can get to the right answer. They plan. So they know what they're going to do and they work towards it. To do that, they only use the facts, and they care very much about what their personal outcomes will be. So here's what I want, here's what I'm going to get. Now, we all know that Citizen 1 is a fiction. Yet we continue to design a world for citizen one. So we keep going. Our first port of call we want to change behaviour is incentives, because of course you change the incentives to citizen one, you're going to have them move in that direction. You give them more information and they'll use those facts to make a good decision. But as we know, that's not the case. We really have to think about, well, who is the person that we should be designing the world for? And that's citizen two. So citizen two, which is a human, has limited time, attention and ability. They're biased towards the present. So they very much sort of care about today, costs today to be avoided, often at much cost. Benefits are greatly prized. You just move even a small distance into the future and suddenly those costs and benefits aren't as important anymore. The presentation matters. So it's not just a case of what information there is, but the way that information is presented can change decisions. We also have social considerations, so we care about what others get, not just ourselves. And finally, when we're making these decisions, we're always looking for cues and shortcuts so that we can quickly get to an answer rather than the full calculation as to what the perfect answer might be. Now, the fact that we're citizen two or claimant two gives us a new set of tools that we can use to change behaviour. And so one word used to describe this toolkit is called choice architecture. And here's a simple example of choice architecture. To change the behaviour of people in a cafeteria, what could you do? Well, you could give them more information about the health of the foods. You could pay them to eat healthier food. But one simple option is simply to rearrange the ordering of the food in the cafeteria. People tend to load their plates to the items they come to first. So Google did this in their campus in one cafeteria and measured the calorie change of their employees, and calorie consumption went down 9% simply through reordering the food that was available. Same food available, so citizen one would have made the same decision, but citizen two, the real Google employee, made a different decision. So what I'm going to do now is quickly walk you through a few little, snapshots of some of the work we've done in workers' compensation and some of the observations we've made. And this here is, the framework that we use within PwC. If you're familiar with the behavioural literature, there's quite a few frameworks floating around, but we find that this one works quite well for our purposes in the consulting world. And I'm going to talk to four of these five lenses, starting with frictions and complexity. And frictions and complexity is the no-brainer in a lot of behavioural science. And it's one of those ones where people go, this is completely obvious, but the fact is we still don't do what the evidence tells us. Now, we all know that even an irrational person, if something's complex, they see it as a cost and they might not do it. What the behavioural science shows is that even small frictions and complexity can change people's behaviour. So an extra mouse click on a website can be the difference between a sale or not. So one little example of a bit of work we did earlier this year for a not-for-profit. You don't need to read the words here, but this, I guess, the picture tells the story. This was their annual fundraising letter that they'd send out. The ask was in the fifth paragraph, text-heavy, no sign of what this thing's about. It's just boring, bland text. I think it was about 400 words on that page. We redesigned that request to simply be simple, to remove all the frictions and complexity. Two sentences, one sentence saying what the not-for-profit wanted, one sentence stating what you should do, and then three boxes which had the three simple steps to donate. And the effect of this was, last year they took 271 days to hit their annual fundraising target. This year they took 21 days, and they've exceeded that target by a long way. And it was simply because the previous letter was just a complex letter that most people probably didn't actually read to the end. And this is reflected all through the workers' compensation world. So here is an example of a letter that was sent to a friend of mine after I was injured in the workplace. So look at it. It's two pages of heavy text. This here is actually a provisional liability letter. And for those who aren't from the New South Wales system, after 7 days is generally one of two letters sent out. Well, this is required to be either provisional liability, giving payments until the claim is finalised, or a reasonable excuse, because there's not enough information available to grant provisional liability, stating that further information is required. So this here's a provisional liability letter, basically having good news and asking for further information to complete the claim. Where's the action in this? So that's where the part of the letter where they actually state, by the way, you've got provisional liability, and what we'd like from you is more information to complete your claim. How many people are reading all the way to that point? Massive frictions and complexity. Then we come to the acceptance letter. Start off with three different passages of legislation. So I guess when Shakespeare said, kill all the lawyers, maybe you'd just been injured in the workplace and received a letter like this. But there again is the decision. So that decision could be right up the front. So again and again, despite the fact we know that we need to write simple documents that communicate what we actually want to tell them and actually putting the action that we want out of them right at the beginning, we continue to send verbose, legalistic letters that don't result in behaviour change. So now to a second lens, the social lens. We care about what others think. So now, here, let's hope this video works in the system. I think it should, hopefully. Okay. Is there a mouse here? Here it is. Okay, so this here, I'll just quick bit of background. So this here is our Capuchin monkeys that have been trained to do a very simple task.
So she gives a rock to us, that's the...
Trained to do a very simple task. Basically, these monkeys hand over a rock, and when they pass that rock over, they get fed cucumber. Now, and I'll do this task all day for cucumber, but there's one thing they love more than cucumber, and that's grapes. So here we have two monkeys doing this task of handing over the rock and getting paid in cucumber or grapes. That's my mouse. There you go, let's try this again.
So she gives a rock to us, that's the task, and we give her a piece of cucumber and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us, and that's what she does, and she gets a grape, and she eats it. The other one sees that, she gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber. She tests a rock now against the wall. She needs to give it to us. And she gets cucumber again.
Okay, so what we have here is we have a monkey that was basically happy to do something over and over and over again for the same bit of payment. Yet as soon as the context was changed, as soon as they saw it as being unfair, suddenly they weren't happy to do it anymore. But there's actually, I guess, the second lesson here, and this is the one I should bring out now, is when they became angry about this, they're actually willing to completely forego the payment that they were receiving for the task. That monkey was willing to bear a significant cost to protest by basically throwing the food back at the experimenter. Now, you think about that in terms of how people react when they are, say, upset during the claims process. You receive a reasonable excuse letter. Not expecting it, it's probably poorly written legalese. What then happens to that claimant? And the form of protest can be very subtle. It can be not returning calls from the claims manager, not taking steps that are in an injury management plan. So by getting off on the wrong foot, there can be quite strong protest and ultimately at that claimant's cost. But there's a flip side to this, there's a corollary. And that's that even small actions can result in punishments or protests which cost that person a lot. But when you have a small positive action, people can actually return quite a lot. So here's a small experiment that was run by the Behavioural Insights team in the UK where they tried to get Deutsche Bank employees as part of their annual charity drive to donate one day of their salary. So a typical rate of joining this is 5%. So what they did is they handed out 1 pound bags of lollies to the staff as they came in that morning. What happened then to those staff? Suddenly 11% of those staff are handing over their pay. And you throw in a personal email from the CEO or a combination of personal emails and the sweets, and suddenly you're up to 17% contribution. This was the equivalent in the end of £500,000 in donations, that extra donations that came through the simple act of giving 1 pound of sweets as people walk in. So while the reasonable excuse letter, say, can generate some quite strong behaviour and response, there's actually a lot of positive things in the workers' compensation system. So think about the idea of provisional liability. Provisional liability for New South Wales workers' compensation claimants is basically a payment that they continue to get despite the fact their claim has not been decided, and even if their claim is decided in the negative in the end, they get to keep that money. It's a really strong positive act. How can we be capitalizing on it and communicating on it so we can generate those reciprocal actions that, ultimately will lead to that claimant returning to work faster? So now to frames. Here's a simple question for you. Two people here, they underwent a medical procedure. Each minute, they marked on a chart how much pain they're experiencing between 0 and 10. Patient A, procedure lasted 8 minutes. Patient B, 24 minutes. Which patient had a better memory of their experience? So the funny answer here is that patient B actually had the better memory of their experience. During the course of having that medical procedure, obviously patient B had objectively more pain. And in fact, even at the moment they were asked at the very end, patient B rated the experience as worse. But a week later, suddenly patient B was recalling a better experience. So why is that? There's basically two main factors that we tend to recall when we're from an experience. One is the peak intensity of that experience. So here, both patients experienced a peak of around 8. The second is the end of that experience. What was the experience like at the very end? So patient A had a pain of 7, patient B a pain of 1. So patient B, because they're looking at the peak and the end of their experience, when they remember that experience, are rated as a less painful experience than patient A does. So again, here you have a question around how are the claimant experiences being shaped? And particularly, how is the end of that experience being shaped? Because the reality is, so putting someone through an injury management plan process, developing out the plan, then trying to get them to engage in certain behaviours which can at times be painful. But what are the end of those interactions like? Framing, here's another sort of a famous sort of example of a frame. The Economist magazine had an offer of 3 different choices here. You could have $59 online access, $125 print access, or $125 print and web access. Which would you prefer? Is anyone here preferring the middle option? Well, that matches survey data. So when US economists surveyed people, basically found 0% chose that middle option. And most people chose the print and web combined. But the interesting thing is what happened when you surveyed people without that middle option. Get rid of it. Suddenly, most people are going the online option only. So what's happening here? Well, the reality is most people don't know what an Economist subscription is worth. If I just came up to you without showing you that ad and said how much are you willing to pay, most people can't put their hand on an answer. They don't know what good value is. Yet the presence of that middle option, $125 for print only, suddenly makes print and web for $125 look like really good value. It gives a reference point against which people can assess. So one of the more interesting conversations I had in this area was from someone from a motor vehicle accident insurance organisation. And they found that they were getting really high ratings from from the injured claimants in the first few weeks. What was happening here? Well, it was actually around their reference point. Most of these people were expecting Centrelink. And so from having a certain reference point that people were using, suddenly they were rating it as quite a good experience. Go several years later, and of course you've had a bit of a selection effect in your population by then, but several years later, that reference link of Centrelink is no longer there. The new reference point is their ongoing relationship with that organisation. Suddenly, just because of that change of reference point, the same level of service is no longer enough. So now to the last of the four lenses I'm going to touch on, cues and signals. So if you've ever seen a tax letter recently, nearly all of them have this sort of thing on the top of it. This one here says, are you among the 8 out of 10 New South Wales taxpayer who submit your tax return on time? Because quite often when we're making decisions, we don't just go, what are the costs and benefits of this decision? Instead we go, what are other people doing? So social norms are one of the most powerful levers in nearly all, I guess all the behavioural sort of experiments that you find out there, because people really like to follow the crowd. So the question here is quite often asked is when you have a group of people engaging in behaviour, where are they engaging in positive behaviours that you can communicate this? If most claimants are doing a certain task, how can you tell them that others are also, that how can you tell the new claimants that other people are doing it? Conversely, how do we make sure that we don't spread bad social norms and tell them that, oh, look, most people aren't doing their injury, aren't following their injury management plan. This is horrible. Of course, as soon as you do that, you've created a new social norm, a new cue that people then use to make their decisions. Another cue that we find quite a lot is the idea of an anchor. So a shop in Sioux Falls in the US was trying to sell soup, put up a poster, no limit per person for their special of 10% off. Sold an average of 3.3 cans each. So then they put up a different sign, limited 12 per person. Suddenly they were selling 7 cans for each shopper who purchased soup. So what was happening here? Again, people don't know quite often what they should do when they see a certain choice. They're looking for simple signs. Here, I see soup on special. How many cans of soup should I stock up on and put in my cupboard? 12 gave them a higher anchor than they obviously had in their mind already. Now, one of the things that the workers' compensation communications are full of are anchors, because it's full of time indications. So here's just a few. I just cut off the iCare website the other day. So provisional liability of 12 weeks. Then, of course, you have for the first 13 weeks, you get certain payments between week 14 and 130. We're always giving all these different times. And although this is important information, it's also the sort of information that people anchor off. So one of the findings we find when you're trying to get people to, I guess, give the information over when they're on provisional liability is they know quite clearly that they've got 12 weeks of provisional liability payments. And so although they won't take that full 12 weeks, if they've been injured for 3 or 4, in the back of their mind they know they've got plenty of time at their sleeves. Maybe I'll just take a few more days before I send that form in. Maybe I'll return that call tomorrow. Instead, can you communicate different anchors, such as communicating the average time that someone's on provisional liability before their claim is finished? So now that I've sort of, I guess, painted a few of these little pictures, I'm going to hand to Chow, who's going to talk about how do we actually take these ideas, and there's a lot of neat ideas in behavioural science, and actually know if they're going to work.
Thank you, Jason. So we've talked about the middle section here, which is the choice architecture and behaviour economics. All of this, when we come to behaviour interventions, come into a three-step process. The first one is analytics and quantitative approach, trying to find out exactly where the interventions are needed. Second step is, we talked about, behaviour architecture. And the third one is running field trials to validate and consolidate whether the behaviour interventions actually worked, giving confidence to management. And there are two types of trials. One type of trial is before and after analysis, where you don't run a control group and a trial group. Second type is a randomized control trial, where you do run a control group and a test group in parallel with each other. And I'll give you an example of both. Now, the first example on your left-hand side is one of a before and after analysis. In that example, we put footprints along the corridors leading to stairs at a professional services organisation. And what we found is that by simply putting some prints and some posters around the place, we've improved the usage of stairs by 40%. And that's a before and after analysis. And after we've taken the footprints and things out, we've still seen a step change. So the status quo at the end of this is higher than the one before. So that's a before and after analysis. The second type is, we'll talk about it later on, is iCare self-insurance. We ran that in conjunction with the Department of Premier and Cabinet. We found 27% increase in return to work activity after 90 days. And we're running two parallel groups, one control group and one test group. And expanding on this iCare self-insurance, it's a trial that involved Allianz, which is one of the scheme claims managers, and the Department of Education within iCare self-insurance, aka New South Wales Self-Insurance Corporation. Three types of major interventions we trialled: simplification, as Jason talked about, simplification of the letters, consistent messaging, and getting the claimant to own and commit to their own injury recovery and management. And through these simple interventions, we tracked three different cohorts through different periods of time, 30 days, 60, 90 days. We actually tracked these for 180 days. After measuring the control group and trial group for the first 90 days, we found a 27% return to work improvement, which is quite remarkable. So how do actuaries fit in? We talked about yesterday, you know, how actuaries fit into behavioural change, behavioural insights. We're coming back to the control cycle. If you think about the actuarial control cycle, behavioural change is a control cycle as well. We design the trial, implement intervention, collect evidence, and an iterative process goes around. And actuaries can help in all of the three steps, as we talked about the three-step approach. In the middle, we can help with pilot design, choice architecture. The start, we can identify behavioural drivers, exactly where interventions are needed. And at the end, actuaries can use their quantitative skills and techniques to give confidence in measurement, making sure that the trials and interventions actually worked. But actuaries alone aren't enough. As we've just heard about from Jason, there's quite a big skill set in behavioural change, behavioural economists, in trying to manage and implement change, creating an optimal environment where people are able to make the right choices to create a win-win situation. Same with iCare self-insurance. It's a work in conjunction with Department of Premier and Cabinet, the Nudge Unit, the actuaries, and both the actuaries and behavioural economists have something to contribute. And combining the different skill sets, it creates quite a powerful proposition. Going forward, we'd like to implement this in definitely more schemes and also trying to do more things to benefit society and societal relevant issues. And now we open up for questions. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. We have two microphones on the extreme aisles, and please just introduce yourself first and then ask your question.
Hi, my question's for anyone of the panel up there. So you gave some examples, Jason, I think, of some letters that a friend of yours had received from a compensating scheme in New South Wales, I believe it was, and you pointed out some of the pitfalls in that, I suppose. Do you have any examples of where some of the suggestions that you've offered in terms of the insights that behavioural sciences can offer, where they've been applied in that type of context and where you've seen a material difference?
So, unfortunately, I guess given a few proprietary reasons for not being able to show nice images of some of the work we've done, but that example I showed of the not-for-profit and the difference between that letter and the request for donation that we sent out this year, that's probably the scale of look and feel change that we're actually doing with our existing clients. Is basically the new letters that go out have only a couple of sentences on the front page. A very clear ask, quite often an image that's trying to create some sense of what this letter is about, and actionable steps. So here are the simple steps that you need to move to the next stage of your claim. So in terms of the results of those, so the main work we're doing this year is still ongoing. We haven't had the benefit of the trial. But I should say that the work that we did with SciCorp and the behavioural team in the Department of Premier and Cabinet last year used some quite similar principles around the simplification of the letters, and so the results that Chow presented there around the 27% improvement after 90 days comes from that. I should say one thing about that simplification, though, is because, of course, lawyers still do rule to a certain extent and there's a lot of legislative requirements. So quite often it's not just a case of sending out a simple one-page letter but a layered document. So to get it through, I guess, the legal team is so there'll be a very clear single front page with an image, simple steps. If that person reads it, if that's all they read, they'll do what we need them to do. But then, of course, then there's subsequent information that satisfies the legal requirements and does give those people who want to read more the information that they can delve into.
Hi, my name's Lennon Stapleton. I just have a question about the Department of Premier and Cabinet that you looked at. Was there a change in case manager behaviour as well as the simplification of communication, or was case manager behaviour consistent as it had always been?
I might answer that one. That's something that's really hard to control for. It was a test control arrangement, and you can imagine that you might put some of your more competent, capable, enthusiastic, excited claims managers into the test group to implement the change, but it is really hard to control for. I think that the results, though, were so significant, and using the stats, they were so statistically significant that despite the potential bias, there was still absolute success with the trials.
So in the work that we're doing with the client at the moment, we actually found that claims manager behaviour was ultimately one of the main things we're trying to change. So coming back to this story about provisional liability and reasonable excuse letters, for the particular sort of claimant population we're dealing with, there was a lot of reasonable excuse letters going out due to a range of issues, English as a second language, low education and the like. And it wasn't just a case of making things simpler, but it was actually a case of helping claims managers understand how they needed to work with those people. One of the tools that we have created to try and assist that is actually just simple checklists. There's a lot of evidence now that even surgeons with 30 years of expertise miss steps when they're doing major surgery. So there's checklists now which simply, you know, check you've got the right person, check you're going to cut off the right leg, that kind of thing. And so in a claims environment, there's actually some similar benefit to having checklists. In that particular case, it was going, how do we get all the information we need in that first 7 days to be able to give them provisional liability and avoid sending them the reasonable excuse letter that might result in protesting behaviour? We found that giving the right tools to the claims managers was probably as important as having the right letter in the claimant's hands.
I'll add a bit on the Department of Premier and Cabinet trial. So there wasn't just one group of tests. So the test teams, I think there were five test teams. And through the measurement, it came out that four of the five test teams performed better than the other one. And so if you think about the case managed behaviour, you'd imagine sort of the same case managers, same enthusiasm in the test groups, but because of the interventions that were designed, four of them performed better than the other one.
Any more questions? Well, time's up, so let's just please join me in congratulating your speakers.